yourself better than me. Welcome to episode 33 of Texting Diddly D. Hosted by a very fine gentleman, Justin Vincent, and his pal, Jason Roberts. Jason, top of the morning to you.
So how long did it take you to get that one right?
Oh, I was working on it for, I guess, like half an hour or something, just practicing it.
That's pretty good. How many different accents can you do?
I think I can do a lot. I can do pretty much anything that I can hear, I can do, actually. I just need to listen to it, and then I can kind of parrot fashion it back.
That's amazing. All my accents sound the same.
Oh, really? Just Jason.
I started out, and they all sound Indian after a while. Sandy will look at me, she's like, yeah, no. It'll start off really good for about like 5 seconds, and then it just goes straight downhill.
Well, if I try and do an Indian accent, I invariably end up sounding like a Welsh person.
So why do you know these accents? I mean, is this something that you practice in your kid, or is it just something that, you know, you just never even had to practice at, and it just...
Well, the Irish one was because I lived in Ireland for 13 years, so...
Okay.
That one. I just got this kind of idea of starting each show with a different accent. Just given the voice acting lessons that I'm doing, I thought that might be fun.
Right. How are those going?
Well, I haven't started them yet.
You're just getting prepped.
I'm getting prepped, yeah. I did an intro in an Indian accent, and I played it to my wife, and she said that it would be too offensive to put out. I'm not quite sure why that is, but... Yeah.
Sandy said the same thing. She's like, yeah, no.
Why is it okay to do an Irish accent but not an Indian accent?
I don't know.
That's weird.
I don't know. It just sounds... Oh, well. It just sounded like... I don't know. I don't know. It just didn't sound right. I wouldn't do it.
Anyway, texting is on fire right now. I mean, we got so many comments for the last show.
Yeah, that was amazing. Well, we have to discount our own. So if we discount ours, you know, we probably together maybe like 12 comments maybe or something. So then we'd be like at least 20 something. From other people.
It was so nice to get that feedback. And it gives us so much to talk about as well, because obviously a lot of the feedback was about whether I should be doing Mash API or TweetMiner. And it's just really cool.
Well, you know what's interesting is these comments are really well thought out. And they weren't just like two sentence, you know, little quips. I mean, people really spent some time thinking about what they wanted to say and suggest, which is really nice. I mean, it really added to the discussion. They're interesting. It also kind of is kind of one thing that's kind of interesting to think about is like, well, what makes people willing to put time into writing a nice comment, a thoughtful comment, as opposed to not?
Right.
And I think part of it is that you and I have spent more time recently actually engaging and actually writing reasonable answers or comments of our own, right?
Right.
Whereas before, I don't think we spent as much time doing that.
Well, I guess it's because right now we're kind of I'm crowdsourcing really via the podcast. Mm-hmm. So it's a very definite interaction with the people listening.
Right.
And one of the things that kept on coming up in the comments about Mash API versus TweetMiner is because people don't know what Mash API is, it's difficult for them to make a judgment. Like, right. I know most people are basically saying, look, stick with TweetMiner because that's the thing that's generating the revenue. But still, no one knows what Mash API is. So I've had this crazy idea of I would be prepared to reveal the full extent of Mash API and give the investor's pitch to a group of Texting listeners. So if that group was big enough, so let's say it was like 50 people, I'd be prepared to do a live webinar to 50 Texting listeners. And basically present the full Mash API concept as if they were investors.
So like a Mash API in all its glory.
Yeah, Mash API in all its glory. What I've got of it so far, the investor presentation, the pitch, the deck, the tech that I've developed so far. Because it would be kind of cool just to get your guys' feedback about it. So if you want to do that, just send me an email, podcast@texinglive.com. And just send an email just saying you want to do it. And when there's... enough emails. I'm going to mention this at every show. And when there's enough emails, then I'll set it up.
Maybe by sometime 2013,
yeah,
I've collected enough emails.
That's the only problem. I mean, it's just, I don't think it's kind of, well, it's not that it's not worth doing, but it's like, I think if you got, if we could get like 50 people on one live webinar, then that would be enough to really get a sense of whether it was a good idea.
Well, because you want a sample space.
Exactly.
You want a statistically significant sample space. So if you have 5 or 7 people, that's not.
Well, exactly. And what's the reason why as well, why I think texting listeners would be so good is because the target market for this product is us, is developers, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, that's interesting. Yeah, well, it seemed like the majority were leaning towards stick with TweetMiner. There was a couple, there was, you know, one or I think it was Philip or Philippe or something. I can't.
Philip Monet.
Yeah. He had suggested maybe splitting the difference, spend a little time on both. And then there was one from Val Booth at the very end. She's like, forget TweetMiner.
Yes.
Follow your passion. You know, sell it, give it away, or shut it down, you know. And which was, you know, an interesting comment. So
that's the old me.
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of interesting. I was thinking about that comment for the last few minutes and for the show. And it got me to this idea of sort of like micro-level passion. Like passion at what level? So there's the overarching passion, your passion of like, you know, what you want to do with your life or what you've been passionate about for the last 5 or 10 years. And then there's like what you're passionate about for the last 3 hours.
You know? Right.
Or what you've been passionate about the last 2 weeks. Because it's easy. When someone's sort of toiling away at a job or in a career or in a relationship or whatever that they're not happy with, they need to start thinking about how to exit that situation and follow their passion. Right. I mean, that's absolutely the case. I think if you don't follow your passion, that's really a sort of the path to misery. And so you want to follow that passion. Now, not everyone is sort of lucky enough that they can make a decent living at their passion. Some passions don't allow you to make a reasonable living.
Yeah.
And in the real world, you have to make some kind of living. I mean, maybe you can live on the cheap, but you know, some things are just like hobbies, you know, that's just all there is. Nobody's going to pay for it. Now here's the other thing though, is you sort of think at the time scale of the passion, because of us as programmers or developers or whatever, it's like, you know, we kind of want to hop, skip and jump from one cool idea to the next, right? I mean, our overarching passion is towards building cool stuff, solving cool problems, writing code. Right.
Well, and something that could even overarch that is the fact of making a living from stuff I create rather than making a living from stuff that I create for other people.
Right. It's sort of a passion of creativity.
Right.
And of craftsmanship of I don't know. Right. It's creating cool stuff. And so if you say, well, my passion is not TweetMiner, it's Mash API. Well, I mean, your passion was TweetMiner a couple months ago.
Yeah.
You're really excited about it, you know.
Yeah.
Now you're not. And well, here's the thing, though, is like anything that people are going to pay for, anything that's going to create a business, anything that you're going to finish is going to require crossing the T's and dotting the I's. You're going to have to do a lot of stuff that's kind of boring and tedious. And whatever it is, I mean, some people hate customer support, some people hate marketing, and some people hate, you know, back-end stuff, some people hate front-end stuff. But you got to do all that kind of stuff. You got to do it all. And if you're not willing to do any of that, if you're like, I want to be completely excited every minute of the day, well, guess what? You know, you're not. Ever.
It can kind of go back to the quality as a fractal concept. So if you're only going to focus on one part, then you haven't done the true fractal aspect of you haven't built the fractal aspect of your business because you've only focused on one little part. You need to put the same effort into all of the aspects. And that's what I mean by the whole fractal concept.
Yeah. I mean, if you only want to do one very, very sort of limited and focus task, then you go work for somebody and you just do X, right? You're like,
right.
I put these squares in these boxes, or I, you know, draw these lines, or I do this, right? I don't worry about anything else. But in that case, most of those people tend to be unhappy. There's been some studies that I've read about that. I can't remember them off the top of my head, but it's like when people are divorced from sort of the relevance and the connection of what they're building to their end users, they don't enjoy it very much. I mean, it's like somebody having like a craftsman or something. You think of something in the old times, someone's like a blacksmith or a tailor or whatever, and people would come into their store or whatever and ask them to, you know, have them create something for them, right? Whereas if you're just sitting in a factory and you're just doing one little small piece, it just gets, it's very dehumanized.
Have you ever worked on a production line?
No.
I have, actually. I have. It's kind of weird.
Yeah?
It's weird. Where? Yeah.
When what, I was, what was
it? Was, it's actually for my uncle who used to own essentially an electronics processing factory. And what they do is they, they'd work for companies, for big companies like Technica or whatever their name is. They do stuff for Ross and for Sony. And basically, stuff would come into the UK in its component form. And then in his factory, he'd basically have people assemble it.
Right.
So I've worked on that, you know, on a couple of those lines when I was like a 16-year-old kid. And it is the most mind-numbing, boring thing to do in the world. You know, all I had to do was like solder on a capacitor or something like that. And it's just like...
After an hour or two of like, this is hell.
Yeah, after an hour or two of just soldering on the same capacitor, it's like, bloody hell. It's like Groundhog Day.
Yeah, I can imagine. I think people get stuck in that kind of a job are generally pretty frustrated. I mean, problem is a lot of people who get jobs like that don't have a ton of other choices unless they completely recreate their lives.
Right.
They have to go back and redo their education or do all kinds of new things, which some people just are too afraid or too trapped or whatever to do. But anyway, I just to sort of finish up that topic, though, I think that Val is right in the sense that follow your passion, right? But your passion is being a technology entrepreneur. Your passion is creating, is solving cool problems, creating stuff. And you're going to have to do, on occasion, you're going to have to do some things that you don't want to do. We all have to do it. Sometimes you have to deal with the accounting crap. Sometimes you deal with the legal stuff. Sometimes, you know, there's stuff that's just kind of boring, but you have to do it. Now, luckily, it isn't usually the primary thing you're doing, but you just have to do these things. And sometimes it's just sticking with it. And I think that whether it's TweetMiner or MashAPI or whatever, there's going to be significant periods of time where you're going to be doing stuff that isn't super exciting. But you got to do it if you want success. Otherwise, we're going to be having the show. We're doing the show 3 or 4 years from now, and you're going to be in the exact same position you are now.
Right.
And that's just the fact. And then you will be like bitching about like, I want to do my own thing. And it's like, well, you got to stick with it. Now that actually transitions into another topic. Two things, actually.
You're going to launch your thing?
No, that is not it right
shoot.
Now. Oh, we'll get to that in a minute. We'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
So I got in contact with Isaac and Arnoff of Essential Desktop because I've brought them up a number of times as an example of how it's done. If my view, they put on a clinic of how you bootstrap a web app from nothing. You don't get tech crunched. You have no connections. You don't get VC investment. You're not a YC Combinator. And you grow yourself into an incredibly successful business. And so they're going to come on next week, which is going to be great.
And you know what's even better? They're not like Balsamic, where they just have this instant huge press about them as well, which is great. And the fact that they're not software, they're a web app, is also really good. They're not desktop.
They're right in line with probably what the majority of our listeners are doing and thinking about. And they don't have any of these special advantages. They don't have, they're one of those chosen few for Y Combinator, or they happen to be connected in with some VCs and they knew all the right
people. It's just a bog standard business that's become successful, and now they've got like 30 people working for them.
Yeah, and it's not 37 Signals. Like, oh, well, because, 37 Signals, those guys will talk about, we'll do this or do that. And
so they're not even kind of blogging and marketing all the time.
No, well, because, 37 Signals, they have a lot of, they have kind of a very clear manifesto. And a lot of some of the criticism is like, what worked for 37 Signals doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work for everybody else because of X, Y, and Z reasons, because they're so popular, because they have so much attention. Yeah, great for them. They can do that, but nobody else is. And some of that may be true. Some of it may not. But I can tell you, Central Desktop had none of those advantages. They still to this day have never been tech crunched, and they're more successful than 95% of anyone who's been covered on that blog. If not more.
Well, that's fantastic. It really is good.
So we're going to have them on next week. I originally was going to have Arnulf, because I said, I'll just get Arnulf, because Arnulf is, he can talk the business and he can also talk tech, so we can kind of get nerdy and talk tech stuff, and we can also talk about the evolution of business. But then it just happened that Isaac contacted me out of the blue yesterday, and he's so fun to talk to, and he's such a funny guy. I'm like, all right, we got to have both these guys on. It'd just be fun, a lot more fun with both of them. So
excellent. Well, well done for setting that up. problem. We're talking to them on Friday. Is that right?
Friday.
Next That's right. Friday. We'll so we'll Friday. Release it sometime very soon after next Friday.
Yeah, yeah. And oh, and they're I think they're doing a big new release of their product. They've totally redone the UI, so it kind of falls in with a little extra promotion for them, which would be nice.
Oh, good.
The other thing is I was thinking about is I got an email from Peter Christensen.
Right.
And he was the guy who commented a week or two ago. He wrote a blog post, and I said
on Mixergy, was it?
Yeah, and he was talking about Mixergy, and he mentioned, you know, the kind of blog the podcast that he thought were good, which are a couple guys shooting the breeze with not line of a plan. Well, right. It turns out he was talking about what's in his mind. It was us and Stack Overflow and .NET Rocks.
Oh, fantastic.
And so a couple things I want to say about that. One, it's funny because Peter initially contacted me because I was interviewed, or I was one of the call-ins for This Week in Startups, like right. The first episode.
How we met.
Which is how we met. And he emailed me, he's like, man, how did you get on that show, right? He's like, I've sent you, Jason Calacanis, a couple emails, and I don't know how do I get on the show, because I want to talk about something I want to do. And I said, well, and I sort of give him an outline of what I am. My email was, and what I suggest, and it turned out a couple weeks later, I was listening to the show, and sure enough,
he was on the show. So he used your template.
I don't know if he used my template, but whatever advice that I gave, maybe it gave him some insight, maybe it didn't. But luckily he did get on, and you know that they have a big audience, and so it worked out. But what happened is, I think Calacanis helped connect him with some funding or some artists to help him with some of the stuff he's doing something called GeekStack. Which seems to kind of reminds me of kind of like those card playing games where it like Magic the Gathering kind of thing, but with like scientists and mathematicians.
Oh, yeah.
Which I thought was kind of a cool idea. And so that was really neat. So I didn't even know that was the same guy, you know, when I originally read his blog post. Right. So it's kind of funny because I keep kind of running into him. It's like on, you know, he's emailing me out like This Week at Startups, and he's writing on our blog. I don't know. It's just kind of small world to keep running into these people. So, anyway, so one thing I wanted to bring up about that also is that he brought up .NET Rocks. And I was like, I never heard of that. What's .NET Rocks?
And
right?
So did, just by the way, so did Philip Monet on the TechSing blog.
Like oh, on the comments.
Yeah, he basically says, I'm just quoting here, I listen to a bunch of podcasts, including Stack Overflow, .NET Rocks. I really like that one. Thirsty Developer, Ruby on Rails podcast, and a few others.
Right.
So, yeah, so just to mention that.
Yeah, yeah. So I went and took a look at it, and what was really interesting, what sort of blew my mind, I have to say, is the number of downloads of their show. In 2008, they had 23 million downloads of their podcasts.
Unbelievable.
But what was really interesting, so you're like, wow, so they're super successful. I would never have thought that podcasts of this nature, of these sort of tech podcasts, could be that big. I mean, in December alone, they had over 2 million of December of 2008. But what's interesting is in their first year, I think they said in 2002, between August and December, they only had 2,500 downloads.
Right.
So it just shows you that you start small. It doesn't matter, right? Because you look at them and you're like, oh, well, they're huge. Like, because we talk about how we want to grow texting, right?
Right.
I mean, obviously, the bigger it is, the more fun and exciting it becomes. So you're like, well, wow, I wonder if we could actually have like 5,000 listeners. Wouldn't that be awesome, right? But you look at these guys, and they're massive. But you look back, and they started in 2002. They didn't do it overnight. It took them, you know, a few years. It was 2006 when they had 2006 they had 3.7 million downloads, right? Or in 2006. So it took time to get there. So it's all just about commitment and sticking with it, and doing a good job.
Well, we've had 19,500 downloads since we've been going.
Yeah, so our rate might be, you know, actually better.
I mean, just for the early phase.
But, you know, we might benefit from a couple other things, stuff like the existence of Hacker News and Reddit, where we got a couple pops.
Yeah.
We might also benefit by the fact that people are more in the habit of having iPhones and iPods and listening to podcasts. 2002 was really early. I don't think anyone was listening to anything.
The thing that amazed me is that there are 2.5 million people who program in .NET. I mean, that's ridiculous. Come on, people, get a clue.
Well, .NET's great. I love. I use .NET half the time, half my day. My mornings are spent building .NET stuff.
It's just amazing, isn't it? They're, like .NET obviously is a very, very well. I mean, because if there's 2.5 million people just listening to that one show, think about how that translates to the actual number of .NET developers around the globe.
Yeah, it's massive.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
Sure. .NET's huge. But I personally like .NET. I've been developing a .NET for the last couple of years. I mean, I've been working at least, I don't know. I've been doing Microsoft development stuff since, you know, the mid-90s. And right. MFC back in the day, and then VB6 and COM, C++, doing VB6 for the front end and COM and all that stuff on the C++ in the back end, and then eventually, you know, .NET and whatever.
Okay, so I've got a couple of topics that I want to bring up.
All right.
Okay, so...
Wait. Is this going to be about Muppets?
No. It's not going to be about Muppets or food or anything like that. Okay, so one thing...
Oh, by the way, I just want to say, everybody, he actually brought up a topic on Muppets last week, and it was so bad he had to cut it out.
Thank you. That's just... Thank you. That's kind.
All right, let's go on.
Okay, I must remember to bring up all the shit that I've cut out that you've said.
Sure you will. Let's go.
In the early shows. Okay, so... So one thing that I've noticed over the last, I don't know, 6 months, every time I turn on my microwave, it brings down my wireless network, right? Mm. And I thought I was going crazy. I thought, okay, my microwave is leaking or something, you know, something weird's happening. Like, why does my microwave turn off my wireless network? So then we moved house recently and I now have a new microwave. And when I turn that microwave on, it brings down my wireless network. So it's like, well, hold on a second. How can two microwaves bring down my wireless network? So I did some research about it and essentially found out that microwaves have radiation frequency, radio frequency leakage, but at a 2.5 kilohertz range, which is exactly the A and G band frequency, especially,
really?
Especially channel 6. You know the way that on your wireless router you can change channels from 1 to 11.
You know that's the kind of thing when you first install your router, you look at stuff and then you never think about it again. So
the default is channel 6.
Okay.
Right. So channel 6 is clashes exactly with microwaves. So what I did was I've found these blog posts about it and thought, oh, well that's crazy, but I'll try changing it anyway. So I changed it to channel 11, and it completely works perfectly, plus it's extended my range of the wireless.
That's really interesting. So you said it's 2.5 kilohertz is the frequency, the
radiation? It's kilohertz or gigahertz. I can't remember which.
Because gigahertz is like phones, right?
It's not radiation, sorry. It's just radio frequency leakage, basically. Frequency. Yeah.
The wave frequencies. Kit in a conflictor because I remember when I bought my router. I mean, I haven't bought a router in a long time, but every time I, you know, you buy one of these pieces of hardware, it's like all these sort of specifications change. It's a whole new nomenclature. It was like, well, we have the A, the B, and then the G, you know, and you're like, what the hell's a G? Yeah. That sounds awesome. I'll get the one with the G, you know. And I think I bought mine like 5 years ago, so I don't know. A G is like the most advanced of the wireless thing, or at least it was years ago. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I definitely, yeah. I mean, just to reiterate, one thing is changing it to channel 11 has really changed the speed, the basic speed. Because before, even just when the microwave wasn't on, I because I'm quite far away from the wireless box.
Okay.
I was averaging about, I don't know, 4 megabits per second or something.
Uh-huh.
With a low signal. But now on channel 11, it's like I've always got a medium to strong signal and I'm always pushing about 40 megabits a second. So.
Wow.
That's something that's probably worth trying. Flicking up to channel 11.
That's cool. I like that. That's cool. You researched it. You solved it. Very nice.
Okay. So I got something else for you.
Go ahead.
One of the people who have commented on the blog, Philip Monet, he brings up the fact that we have inspired him to, well, let's not inspire him, but we've given him the motivation. As in his own words, you've given me the motivation to work on my own web concept, which is myskillsmap.com. And mm-hmm. What I thought might be really interesting to do was to do a critique of it.
Okay. Well, first thing one thing I like to say about that is that's awesome.
Yeah.
Just the fact that you and I talking about this stuff, that helps anybody get excited about doing something and making them feel like, hey, I can actually do this, man, that's great, because you can, right? It just takes, more than anything, the desire to do it and willingness to just continually do it. I remember, it was Joshua Schachter who did Delicious. Is that his name? Am I pronouncing correctly?
I can't remember.
Whatever. The guy did Delicious. And he was working in an investment bank, I think, writing Perl code or C++ code or something. And in the mornings, he would work on Delicious, his own little thing.
Right.
And that's where it grew out of. And I think, and there's a lot of examples of these cool projects that became not only successful websites, but financially successful. And, you know, they just worked on their side, but he consistently did it. You know, you don't have to say, well, you know, I have to work all nights and weekends and put all my free time to it. It's like, well, a lot of things just start small, just a little bit every day. You'd be surprised what you can do an hour a day. Because, you know, what happens is if you only say, I only got an hour or 45 minutes to work on this thing, you're, before you even got to start doing it, you're in the back of your head going, okay, when I do this, I'm going to, you already have it kind of list, the list of things that you want to knock out. You already half solved them all in your head before you even sit down, because you know you don't have much time to screw around. Whereas if you know you got 8 hours, you might just sit there and like, ah, I'm going to check some email, look at Twitter and look at Hacker News. And it's like 3 hours go by. You're like, crap.
It's like always give a job to a busy person.
Because they'll get more done. They're more efficient.
Listen, so, about this critique concept, I was thinking that, you know, given the people who listen to our show, like they're people like us who are creating products like us, like, wouldn't that be a good section for us to have? Like, basically, you send us in your website and we'll critique it. First of all, you know, because an important thing is, do we get it when we go to the site? Do we get it? Do we understand it? Does it make sense? Does it fall in with the criteria of all of the knowledge that we've gained through reading the various different business blogs that we've been reading?
Right.
What do you think of that
but
as a section of the show?
Keep in mind that, you know, it doesn't necessarily make us experts. Right.
No,
I mean, we're just two people.
Exactly. It doesn't make us experts, but when, you know, we're just two people, but what it does do is it gives the person who we're critiquing the website, they can sort of listen to our stream of consciousness as we're looking at it, as we're moving through it. And that's pretty valuable, you know, don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's fine. Well, I'd be more than happy to. I think especially for our listeners who, if they're working on stuff and they're putting some time into stuff and they're actually commenting about it on the blog, I mean, tell us about it. If you'd ask, if you'd like us to, that's great. I mean, I like to help anyone out we can, whether it's just having us talk about it and if that helps pick up an audience for them a little bit. Obviously, our audience isn't that huge, but, you know, 400 or 500 people is 400 or 500 people that 400 or 500 people they didn't have before. And these are pretty good group, pretty sharp group of people. And if they're commenting on it, then these other people who are their listeners will have to, might take a chance to take a look at it.
It's actually true. Yeah. So basically what may happen is that other people may listen to us, our critique, and then they'll put more comments about it on the texting chat board.
Yeah.
But we just
you
to say,
what we're doing, you know, what we're doing, we got like a texting think tank.
That's right. That's right. And just
we've got some smart people on this blog, I can tell you, but just by the people, by the things that people are talking about, there's a bright people. So,
but for anyone listening, Jason and myself have not discussed this concept before this very moment. So I'm bringing this to him like completely cold. So I was just thinking, Jason, you know, let's go through myskillsmap.com. I'd like you to go to the site and just see if you get it. I'll just text you the link.
I get it. So essentially what it's about is it's like the equivalent of a portfolio for developers. Instead of just saying, I've designed these things, here are the kind of projects I've worked on, here are the skills that I have. Is that kind of what it is? They can be embedded in other sites as a widget as well?
I think so.
So if I have expertise in Python and SQL Server and, you know, whatever, JavaScript.
Right.
I would talk about my progress. Now, what is the progress indicator of that? What is that?
See, this is interesting. That's your take on it, right? So that's what you think it is. Okay. So what I think it is, you know, when you go to a website like Odesk or Elance,
okay,
and you have a section that basically where you can take tests to prove how good you are at a certain language or not.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of think it's like that section of a website of Odesk turned into a whole product.
Well, there was a website that did, I can't remember, where you would take, I'm sure it still exists, where you take certification tests and you can take them like in any number of technologies. Do you know what it is?
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of with a K.
I don't know what it is. But what I I think my skills map is I think it's that, but where you don't take tests, you just enter your own evaluation of yourself.
You just say, I'm an expert at this, I'm competent at this, I'm a novice at this other technology. Is that kind of, that's kind of it?
I don't know. I mean, that's what that, I don't know if that's exactly right, but I'm just saying that that's what I think from looking at it, from just
your quick,
scanning.
Your initial look. So I wonder what the business model is that as a user, I'd want to get my skills, sort of a web resume in a way, so that employers can find me. So if they're looking for someone with a particular skill set, they might search the skills map.
Could be. Let me just come back with a few initial pieces of feedback from my perspective.
Okay.
So one thing that we can see is that you can add a skills widget on your blog, and this enables you to sort of showcase how well you're doing. But what's very important on a site like this is the look and the feel and the trustability of it via the design aspect. Do you know what I'm saying? So
yep.
my gut reaction about this is that he needs to work with a really good designer, and mm-hmm. to make something look very professional. It needs to look like I took down some notes before. Like it should look really polished and professional, something like LinkedIn or Odesk, possibly Mint. You know what I'm saying? Because if you're going to put a widget on your page, you know the way when you see widgets for like SSL certificates?
Sure.
You know, they make the site look trustable. And that's like a hugely important aspect of having an SSL certificate.
Right.
You know, you need it to look good for the people visiting. So given that this thing is a similar kind of thing, I think that it needs to be designed to the same level, to the same standard. And going back to quality as a fractal, I think that once again, the design needs to be really strong on a project like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of lacking.
I think, obviously it's the first version, so you just get
and developers up there aren't, and you go. Developers aren't designers, you know. Well, very few developers are designers. I mean,
you got to start somewhere. You know, you can't spend $10,000 with a designer, you know, out of the gate. It's just you do what you can yourself, and then you go from there. And I think the first thing I might say is that the only thing that strikes me is there's a lot of text, a lot of copy.
Yeah.
And if you can reduce that down and simplify it and use some images or some other things, I think you'd be better off. I mean, there's one thing you hear a lot when they talk about these sort of design critiques is that in A/B testing is they say people don't read.
Right. No,
they're not going to read all this stuff. And even if you think, it's just everything is really important, they're still just not going to retain it all. So you have to figure out a way to reduce it. You know, the old saying, a picture's worth 1,000 words. So if you could use a couple images, a couple of icons or something that can give the impression of what's going on without them having to read a bunch of text. It also reminds me of one other thing. It's like, or another example is like, you know, I've talked about how I coach and manage this men's soccer team.
Right.
For a number of years. So we've done it for about 10 years now.
Yeah.
And it's all, you know, it's a men's team. And so it goes to halftime. And a lot of times you have this desire to say a bunch of stuff. But the reality is, no one's going to remember most of it, if any of it. So I usually will go up there and say like one or two things, tops. If I go three or four things, they're not going to remember a single thing. Period. That's just it. And so you may have like seven or eight things that you think need to be said, but you know what? You just pick one or two.
Yeah.
And if there are really critical things that like one of the players needs to know, you go to them specifically and you say, hey, Josh, I need you to stick with this guy. Do not let him get behind you. Period. You know, and he's like, okay, that's it. You know, just do that for me, you know, whatever it is. And I think that's it. You give people too much information, they're not going to remember any of it. Or their eyes are going to glaze over and go away. So,
will you also need to spell, okay, this is what I think, in three sentences. I mean, and when I say sentences, I mean each sentence of like five words. And the best example I can give off the top of my head, I'm sorry to say, is tweetminer.net. But just because I spent so long thinking about it, is you need to break down your concept into a very, very short block of sentences. So just explain what the benefits are and explain what it does and try and do that so that someone can read that within, I don't know, 10 seconds and then understand exactly what your site is.
Well, you know, another truism, which is worth thinking about, is the old one of show, don't tell.
Right.
Show us what it is. Don't tell us about it. Because he's writing a lot of sentences. I mean, they might be like they're not long sentences, but they're bullet points of 5 or 6 bullet points. And, you know, I have to read all this stuff. It's like, don't tell me about it. Just show me. I want to see exactly what this thing is. And you know, the thing I've noticed, I don't know, it'd be interesting to hear what your opinion is on this, but there's the demo, like people create screencasts and stuff, which are pretty cool. And I think they're useful. But I know sometimes I'm just not in the mood to write it, watch a screencast. Can I just see 2 or 3 images? I just want to see 2 or 3 images in 5 seconds. I don't want to watch a 3-minute demo. I just don't have the time.
Well, that's why on the front page of tweetminer.net, there's 3 images and there's a demo video.
There you go. Because if you're lazy like me, I'm just not willing to commit. I'm not willing to commit to even a 1-minute screencast, even a 30-second screencast. It's like, hey, it's buffering and blah. Just let me see a couple images. And if I'm intrigued by those screenshots, I go, oh, okay, that was cool, you know. Then I might read a little bit more, and then maybe I'll watch like a 2 or 3 minute screencast.
But I still need to understand how this can bring something to me. Like I think I'm the target market. I mean, because anyone who wants to build a career is the target market for this, right? So what I want to understand is how does this give something to me? And the pricing, the pricing page isn't working at the moment. But when I looked at the pricing page before, I think it was something like $5 a month. $5 a month for one project and $9 a month for an unlimited amount of projects. That's also very interesting. Like, how would you price something like this? Like, if you're targeting consumers, the pricing is very, very difficult. Whereas if this was a system that was built for companies, and so that companies could direct employees to this, and then employees could do their tests, et cetera, then you could go enterprise-level pricing. But because this is targeted towards consumers like myself, and then that's the impression I get from it. Maybe it is enterprise targeted, but I'm just thinking, even $5 a month feels, you know, a bit, it feels weird. I mean, would you pay $5 a month to have a widget saying how well you'd done?
Well, I certainly wouldn't want to put my stuff on a free site, right? It would just seem like BS. It was a free site, so I think it's worth charging something. I don't know, but
Somehow he needs to make it believable. Somehow he needs to make it that everything on the site's believable. Anyone who looks at the site's believable, and he needs to sort of represent himself as almost like those antivirus sites represent themselves as, like, you know, we're the standard.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it'll have to evolve towards that, right? It doesn't instantly. I mean, sure, he just got this up, so the fact it's not going to instantly be looked that way. It's going to take months of evolution to create a look like that, right? To evolve towards a look like that.
Okay, so it's an evolution. So looking at this site, what would you suggest the first thing that he do is?
Show, don't tell. Catch on the copy. Don't tell.
Right.
And I think one thing I was going to mention is that he doesn't talk, at least as far as I can tell, doesn't talk so much about the benefits. He talks about the features, but what are the benefits? I mean, why do I care about this site? And I think that's... And I think you hear a lot about that. It's like, you know, you want to tell people, you know, you want to give them the benefits, not a feature list.
Exactly.
They understand why they should care. What's in it for me, you know?
Because that's the thing that I'm lacking looking at it. I want to know why I want to use this. Like, what?
Why? Not what. Why.
Why? Exactly.
Show, don't tell, and why would be my two things. So I don't want to tell him too much, right? We tell him too much, he's not going to remember, right? No one's going to remember.
Well, he can like rewind and listen.
Yeah, but you know, he's...
But the other thing is...
My two things. Show, don't tell, and why should I care?
Okay, so you say show, don't tell, and I say what, and you say why. Okay, I say design. Hire a designer. And it doesn't have to be like a $10,000 designer. Like, you can get designers on Elance who've done great work. You can get designers on Odesk who've done great work. A couple of $100 and you can get a great design.
99 Designs, I think it does stuff like that too. And now you have Haystack, or which is now called, like, what's the one that 37 Singles does? It's something Folio. It was called Haystack, but they changed it to something else.
Can I just say my other thing? And this goes in front of the design, okay?
Okay.
So do this before the design. Get Balsamic Mockups or some other tool like that. And get the homepage mocked out perfectly in such a way that it deals with all of the other things that we've said. So by using Balsamic Mockups, get to a point where you can get the front page so that it shows and doesn't tell, so that it explains why people want to use it with an instant, you know, just instantly looking at it, you know why you want to use it. And then that mockup that you work on, and this isn't something that you just do in 10 minutes. I mean, really spend a few days thinking about this mockup of the homepage. That's the mock-up that you then give to your $200 designer.
What are you, a balsamic affiliate or something?
No, I'm not. It's just that it's the I've proven
I'm
it over
I'm
the.
I'm kidding. I love Philly. I love balsamic. His stuff's awesome. I'm just kidding.
It's just that since I've started using that fits so well with all the other agile stuff that I do, the mind mapping, and it is the best first phase to go from the brain to something in the real world. You know, just the first step.
Rather than just doing it straight in HTML, because it's just a slower process.
Exactly. You can go through so many more iterations with a tool like Balsamic. So when I'm doing the homepage of TweetMiner, I mean, in a day, I can probably go through a couple of hundred different iterations by moving things around the page, you know? Whereas with HTML, it's hard to get one iteration.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
And yeah, well, you know, that actually leads into another. I think, well, so we're pretty much done here with my skills map. I don't want to.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
You know, I think we've probably spent enough time on it. And yeah, I mean, we can try to see if people like this. And I want to sort of commend Philip for doing it. You know, is it Philippe? It's Philippe, I pronounce it right. For doing it. That's awesome. You got the first step, the hardest part.
Yep.
So anything that we're critiquing or criticizing, you know, notice. I mean, I know I'm going to get torn a new one when I release mine. And, you know, it's just, we're all going to have to go through it a little bit. So just, you know, great stuff. Just keep up the good work.
So I guess there's a disclaimer, you know, look, we're just a couple of guys talking on a podcast. So.
No, but you got to make sure that, people have to understand that, because, you know, everybody wants to get critical. You know, we're going to give a critique, right? I want to tell you everything that's wrong with what you're doing.
Yeah.
And that's sometimes it's hard to take. You know, you're working on something, you're trying to get it out there, and then everybody wants to be like the critic and tell you why your stuff sucks. You know, but so you need a little bit of positive feedback, right? I mean, people need a little bit of encouragement to keep pushing forward and not succumb to this, everybody's just...
Well, the one positive thing that I can say, and it's a pretty important positive thing, is I get the fact that this could be good. Like, I think that if you can get this right, it would be great to have a new standard, like a new gold seal standard for displaying where you're up to and what skills you've done. I think it's
kind of cool, the widget concept. If everybody had on their blog and stuff, like this is what I can do.
Yeah.
This is what I'm great at.
As long as it's trustable.
Yeah, no, that's very cool. I mean, especially if you had like you know what would be kind of interesting is like, you know, on LinkedIn where people will be recommended by other people.
Yeah.
Kind of verified. If you had something like that, you said, okay, you know, I'm a JavaScript expert. Right. And then it has like three, and you see something like three check marks or three X, and you mouse over it and it shows like a pop up or something or more information like from three projects you've done, and a little snippet of like, you know, so and so did awesome work for JavaScript. He did this drag and drop, blah, blah, blah. You know,
that is a really good idea. And to take that one step further, actually hook it directly into LinkedIn via the API. So if you could find some way of people being able to give their feedback on LinkedIn and that feedback hooking directly into myskillsmap.com, that'd be very cool.
Facebook. I mean, can you integrate with Facebook?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you could integrate with anything, but it's just a question. I mean, LinkedIn's a very believable, trustable thing. So if someone gives you a reference on LinkedIn, if you could then somehow tie that reference up to myskillsmap.com, that would be very trustable.
Yeah, because I just think that you saying how good you are at something is only worth so much, and you have to figure out how to back it up, right? Like, everybody has, like, I know Ruby, and I know, you know, .NET, and I know blah. Well, how well do you know it? You know, everybody says they know stuff, and obviously there's massive gradations in capability for everything. And people aren't always the best critic of their own ability. I can tell you that right now. I mean, I know I always do these sports analogies, but I think they're kind of funny, is that a friend of mine used to always say, is like, everyone thinks they're a little better soccer player than they are. You know, when they get on the field, like, they think they're awesome, and you're like, yeah, he's okay, you know? And, you know, so you just have to remember that sometimes you think you're great, and there's a lot of people who are better than you. So I don't know. But if you have other people who can vouch for you, and you've done work for, whether people you've worked with on an open source project or people you've done a client project with or former employers or whatever, you know, any of those kind of yeah, I don't know, validations just makes it worth that much more.
You know what else you could do? Just listen to your talk there. You could hook into Odesk. You could hook into Elance and take the data that's on those pages and tie that up with your account. Because really, once again, you know, the hard part is how do you make this believable? Well, like Odesk and Elance have already gone to huge lengths to make stuff believable and trustable through their tests and through the different systems that they've got, and LinkedIn through the recommendation. If you basically piggyback on all those guys' hard work of making something trustable, and then my skills map just shows that in one consolidated place, there you go. You've got so much work already done for you by these other vendors.
Yeah, I think that's cool.
Okay.
I like it.
Okay, let's move on.
Okay, so I had something else that made me think of something else. Oh, you know what it made me think of? This is a topic I was sort of playing around with my mind if I want to bring up, but is the idea of design, working with designers.
Right.
I have never had good luck with that. And even with people, even working with people who were pretty experienced, seemed to be pretty talented, who seemed like they wanted to, you know, really help me out. And I found it a very frustrating process. And most of the entrepreneurs that I've talked to, they had the same experience. And it's not because the people they're working with weren't, say, talented or competent. It's just the process of getting a designer to build what you have in your mind and what you kind of envisioned is so difficult. It's so frustrating. And it's like thinking that you're just going to send off some specs and you're going to pay someone $500 and then you're going to have like, hey, here's my awesome web app design.
It's That's
like
very rarely going to happen.
I look at it and I'm like, this is crap. It's totally wrong. What are they even thinking about? I don't know. What's your experience with that?
Well, it's different for me because I've done a solid year of just design. So it's different for me because I sort of consider myself to be somewhat visually okay. Mm-hmm. You know, I understand the basic concepts of some of the typical designer tricks are color theory to make sure there's space. You know, you don't have words next to a border. You make sure that there's some padding, just simple things like that. You make sure that the page balances out. Like if you have a small box on the left and then a larger box on the right, then on the line above, you put the small box on the right and the larger box on the left and just things like that. So for me, what I would do is I would use some kind of tool. I'd either mock it up in Photoshop or Balsamiq and then hand it to the designer and get them to basically take the basic blocking that I'd given them and convert that into a design.
Right.
But for you, I mean, how well could you work with a tool like Balsamiq?
Yeah, you know, here my ability, it tends to be around this level. Like I'm a good designer for the non-designers.
Right.
You know, I'm like right at that level. It's like I remember in college we had like art and design 101 or cut and paste. And I remember, you know, you'd first look at a course like that and you're like, oh, that's going to be, I'm going to take that, right? Because in college we had to take at least one or two art and music credits.
Yeah.
And people were like, oh, man, do not take cut and paste. You do not, believe me, take, you know, art history or music theory. You know, you write a few papers, but you do not want to cut and paste. Sounds like it's going to be easy. And I just hated writing papers so much that I was like, forget it, I'm taking it anyway.
Right.
And I was, you know, it'd be like a two-hour studio class. And I'd knock the thing out in like 45 minutes. So I'd do like two or three projects just for the hell of it. You know, I'm sitting there and it was fun. But other people were dying. They could not do them. And they would get, and by like fourth week, they were behind like three projects.
And what, like, this is design, is it?
It was like, you know, it's like, yeah, it was just basic design theory, color theory, spacing, you know, white, I don't know, whatever, you know, creating negative space. I mean, that kind of stuff. And most of the people in the class were struggling and they hated it and it was painful. I was, you know, probably the best in that class of non-artists.
Right.
And then so I took a class, like a actual painting class with art majors, right? And I was like the second to the worst. of the 10 people. So that's kind of where I'm sort of in that no man's land.
So
of like,
explain your frustration with working with designers. What's been your experience? Like, what's the typical workflow and how's it turned out?
Well, I'll sit down and I'll have like, you know, I'll usually have a conversation with them for an hour and explain to them like what the application does and walk them through it. And then I kind of like what I think the feel should be. And I'll give them some examples of, walk them through examples of a few websites that I like that I think have a sort of a type of a look,
right?
You know, that I like, and colors that I think, and keeping some things in mind. And then come back with something and it's not even remotely close. And I'm just like, oh my God.
But is it to do, is what they come back with, is the page structurally wrong? I mean, do they come back with the wrong concepts of controls and journeys, or they just come back with the wrong design.
Yeah, you know, I mean, usually it'll be like three or four screenshots, right?
Right.
Of like, you know, of like the main, the main sort of pages in the on the web app, and you know, because then you can obviously you can sort of go from there, because other sites are using some variation on that.
Right.
And they're usually just it's just I don't know, it's just wrong. I'm looking at like, this is just not going to work at all. This is not what a web app looks like. It's not, you know, like a community college, you know, front page or something. You know, I mean, it's just like, okay, this looks like a law firm's, you know, about page or something. It's just, what are they even doing? I'm like looking, I go, I don't know. I mean, see, the thing is that I am visually good enough that I have a good eye, and most stuff that I look at, I think sucks, and I'm very particular. But I have a very difficult time reaching anything close to what I expect, so I'm very frustrated with myself.
I think.
So let's say. Yeah. So what I end up doing in the end is I end up trying to do as much as I can on my own, and I keep it real simple. I do not try and get cute. I get a couple, you know, a primary and complementary color, and an accent color that I think are going to work, that are the right kind of colors. And I try and keep it real simple, because if you try and get cute and you try and get fancy, you're not nearly good enough to do that unless you're a experienced designer, and it's going to look terrible. So keep it real simple. And also, what I try and do is I look at a variety of different web apps that I think have solved similar design problems that I'm trying to solve, and I keep those in mind without trying to duplicate them or imitate them necessarily. I'll just say, okay.
You keep saying design problems, but do you mean design or do you mean information architecture? And controls.
I think it's all kind of a similar thing, you know,
because like they're two very separate things.
Design
is basically, okay, how can I explain this? Like, the design of the Apple website is very sparse and spacious. There's a lot of white. It's very crisp. There's a lot of darks, you know, like very crisp text against a white background with very subtle silver grade. That's the design. But the actual information architecture is like a main nav going across the top that basically allows you to flick between the different information areas of the site, right? So they use that. So those are two very different things, which you shouldn't get confused.
So you have things like, right, you have information architecture, right? Do I have a main navigation at the top, or is it running down the left column, or is there a primary one at the top and sort of a sub-navigation, those kind of things?
Yeah.
But there's also things like, okay, there's a couple buttons or there's a couple links that need to be really brought into focus. What color should they be?
On every page?
Well, you know, who knows? I'm just thinking of an example. I'm not talking a specific example. I'm talking in generality, right? So you just have to think about, like, okay, this is an important button, right? It needs to have a different color. It can't just be a typical gray button. Okay, well, what color is it? Well, is that going to be my accent color? Has it balanced out with another, you know, color? It's like you have to take all those things and keep them in mind. And it's... You know, I'm just on the threshold to be able to do it, so I have to work really hard, and I can get something that I'm usually like, okay, this is, you know, this is all right, but it's frustrating for me. It's exasperating.
I mean, the advice that I would give to anyone with that problem that you're talking about there is to draw out the homepage and the main function pages on napkins. And to just keep on drawing them out on napkins. And if you want to do it in software, then use Balsamiq. But just
can I use a
napkins.
Piece of paper?
You can use a piece of paper if you want. And basically,
napkins are preferable.
Yeah, napkins work. Piece of paper works. But just basically get down the essential information architecture, the essential concepts, the really basic things. And don't, you know, draw it once. But now go through a phase of maybe anywhere up to 50 iterations of just making sure that all those components are in the right place. Just keep on looking at it, tweaking, and get the basic blocks in the correct place. Because if you give the basic blocks to a designer and you've really thought about it, they don't have to do that, because that's exactly what they're going to do, right? They're going to go away and think about your product and come up with their concept of navigation and information architecture. And they're not going to have anywhere near as much of a good idea as you are about it.
Well, you know...
And you're going to be unhappy with what they come back with.
Another thing, as I'd say, is I wouldn't worry too much about the design early. I mean, you get something basic that works, because you need to fill out what the product is even doing. Spend a bunch of time figuring out, because you can spend so much time just fretting over the design, screwing around the design. You spend a day or two just sitting there working on just one page. And then at the end of the day, you're like, you know what? This page doesn't even matter now that I think about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of, it's premature optimization.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you look at something, remember like Delicious, right? I mean, you talk about a function utilitarian type of design, but it was fine. Nobody cared because it worked.
Well, Craigslist is the best example of functional.
Yeah. Well, that's the alt, right. So that's sort of the canonical example of utility over function over fashion or something.
Yeah.
You know, Delicious was another thing. I mean, Delicious nowadays, I think it's been, you know, it's the Yahoo has redesigned it and it's got more of a face on it, but you know, I think people like it less than they did in the past.
Okay. So I've got another, a different topic for you. Yep. I've recently found out that TweetMiner has been blocked by Trend Micro's, essentially, they're installed in lots of corporate networks.
Uh-huh.
So TweetMiner is a filtered site now. So if you try and get to TweetMiner, it will be blocked. The same as many social network sites, because banks don't want people using that kind of site. But essentially, I've just from a little bit of research about it, it's not just limited to banks. It is, you know, millions and millions of people are affected by this thing, this Trend Micro thing. And I just wondered, what do you think about that? And what do you think I should do about that?
Are things like TweetDeck and Hootsuite and all, and Twitter, are they all blocked?
They're all blocked, yeah.
Yeah, you know, fine. What are you going to do, right? I mean, you're thrown in. Yeah. At least you're big enough to show up on somebody's map.
Yeah.
Right? For them to even care about you, that's actually a good sign.
So you take it as a positive?
I would take it. I mean, look, if TweetMiner and Facebook and TweetDeck and all them, I'd say you're a good company, right?
Okay.
You're a good company. Don't worry about it. If you were like, if you couldn't get them to block you, like, you should block me. I'm just like them. They're like, nah, you're not. You're totally.
Well, the frustrating thing is that one of TweetMiner's users basically said the reason why they liked TweetMiner was they could use it. It meant they could use Twitter from where they worked. Now they can't.
Right.
but okay, so that's one thing. I added HTTPS to Twitter then, and apparently you can use it via HTTPS. Sorry, I added HTTPS to TweetMiner.
Right.
Which is another step that had to be made. Okay, so that's the end of that discussion. I do have one other thing.
Go ahead.
This is an advertising concept that I thought of for TweetMiner, and I want to see whether you think it's insane or not.
Okay.
Okay, you know the way that in No Agenda they're always asking for, they're always begging for money.
I haven't listened to it that much, so okay. I do remember.
In the No Agenda podcast, they're always begging for money. Do you think that it would be worth tithing 10% of TweetMiner's profit to No Agenda on a monthly basis for like 6 months so that they mentioned it every month to their 100,000 listeners?
Do
you think that would be too expensive?
I don't know. I mean, how much would they charge? They don't do any advertising, do they?
No, they don't do any advertising, but they will. If you donate to the show, if you kind of give them some money, they'll mention you or your product or whatever.
You know, you can experiment with it. Yeah, talk to them, send them an email, see what they'll say. See what they say.
I guess
you know. I actually sent Dvorak an email, and he responded. So, the reason I emailed Dvorak was that I had reserved a domain called techgrouch.com and techgrump like 2 years ago or something like that. I mean, it was sort of, I was almost thinking it would be funny if there was a counterbalance to all the cheerleading of TechCrunch.
Right.
And I came with the idea of TechGrouch so you could have this sort of cynical counterbalance to that.
I was
talking about doing it with Isaac from Central Desktop.
All right.
But he kind of was like, you know what? I don't know if I can do that. Because you're going to make yourself out to be kind of an ass, right?
Right.
And I'm not really that much of a hard ass. So I thought it would be funny, but that's not really my personality. And so I never really did anything with it. I just had it reserved, and that was kind of a funny domain name. And you know, in GoDaddy, like you have these domains, and they kind of like auto-renew on you.
Yeah.
So I had it for like 2 or 3 years. And then I happened to notice that he had created this show called Tech Grouch. And I said, so I emailed him. I said, hey, I got techgrouch.com if you want it. You can have it for free. He's like, cool. You know, and then he didn't do anything. I emailed him a couple weeks later. I'm like, do you want it? Because it's about to expire. And he's like, yeah. And then I was like, it's going to expire. And he's like, I missed it. I'll have to tell this guy at the movie to get it. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm not going to renew it again. If you want it, grab it. I'll exchange it with you, or I'll just let you know it's about to expire and put your like those things you can say, like alerts that say that grab something and expires. But
so that, no, that's
the that was my sole interaction with Dvorak.
Okay, so let me tell you mine. So I was working as at home as usual. And this guy in a white baller suit. Now, this isn't Dvorak, but I'll explain how this gets to Dvorak. This guy in a white baller suit walks down into my backyard and climbs into a tree and starts putting these little white boxes in the tree. Little cardboard boxes.
Whoa, back up. What are you talking about? Is this a dream or is this reality?
No, this is...
Were you high? What are you even talking about?
I'm telling you...
Where? Was this in England or the U.S.?
The U.S.
Were you living in Silver Lake?
No, like a couple of months ago.
So some guy in a
white boiler suit.
Boiler suit.
Right?
What's a boiler suit?
You know, like a workman's suit.
Oh, like a jumpsuit?
Yeah, like a white jumpsuit, right? With a weird kind of hat and mask. Walks into my backyard and basically climbs into a tree on a ladder and starts
that happens every day.
And starts putting these white cardboard boxes in the tree. And I'm like, what the hell is this? What the hell is this guy doing, right? So I watch him as he's sort of kind of, you know, moseying around the tree for like half an hour. And then he finally climbs down from the ladder and I go over to him and I'm like, excuse me, what are you doing in my backyard? And he explains that he is, he works for the council. What do you call that? Is that the council or the government over here? What do you call it?
The council of elders?
Yeah, the local.
We call our government.
What do you call the local authorities? We call it the council.
City council, I guess.
Yeah, city council, yeah. So what he's doing is he's working on a scheme to make fruit flies infertile.
Huh.
So these boxes basically set it up that fruit flies that he releases in these boxes will breed with natural fruit flies and make the strain of them infertile. And that's what he was doing. And I just thought, wow, that's weird.
Why? So because they have an infestation of fruit flies?
No, not that I haven't noticed. But
well, because you are renting the house, right?
Yeah.
So you may not have gotten any informed of that. Like the owner of the house may have been communicating with the city council and received information on that. So that's why you didn't even know about it, right? Because you're just a renter. And
I just thought, that's kind of bizarre. And it's the kind of thing that No Agenda would talk about. So I emailed.
It was some kind of conspiracy, the fruit fly conspiracy.
Yeah, exactly. And he basically sent me back a mail saying, oh, yeah, I've known about that for years. That's not interesting.
That's not interesting. That's funny.
So that was my email with Dvorak.
It's kind of funny when you actually email people who are sort of famous or semi-famous and they actually sometimes will get back to you.
Right.
Oftentimes not.
Web famous.
But... web famous, yeah, web famous. So that's sort of like a D-celebrity. Yeah. So, okay, I got another topic.
Okay, shoot.
How to be lucky. Did you see that topic? It was a article that popped up on Hacker News.
Right.
And one of the interesting things about it, they took like a group of people who consider themselves extremely unlucky and a group that consider themselves very lucky. And I guess really followed them around and interviewed them and tried to figure out what was going on. And I guess one of the things that really was a differentiator is
Can I take a guess? Can I take a guess before you say what they actually found out?
Go ahead.
Okay. People open themselves up to opportunities more.
That's right.
That's basically what it was.
Well, that was right. They opened themselves up for opportunities. They were less sort of routine oriented. In fact, one of the good examples, this person said, okay, I'm going to a party. I'm going to make sure I talk to anybody who's dressed in a blue shirt. like completely random. It forced them into random behavior, which is something I talked about a number of episodes about, the exploration versus exploitation.
Right.
Which is that, you know, the optimal learning agents have something like an 80-20 exploit-explore. So 20% of the time you're just doing random things, trying random paths to see if you had locked yourself into a local local optimum.
And so I'm working on the exploitation with TweetMiner versus the exploration.
That's right. You're trying to exploit, squeeze that thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's kind of fractal too at every level, right? There'll be certain features you're working on, you know, all I have to do is improve this and I'll get, and then there'll be certain features you're going to try, random stuff. You say, okay, well, you know, doing some tithing some revenue to No Agenda is an explore, right? That's a complete random thing. Who knows? Right. So you can do it at every level in your life, of explore and exploit. And but I think, yeah, one of the problems is that we get stuck in sort of these comfort zones and these habits, and we don't force ourselves to try and do new things. And oftentimes those new things, I would say oftentimes, enough of the time, they lead to interesting, life-changing opportunities. Like, for instance, this show, right? The fact that you randomly contacted me out of the blue because you heard me on... interviewed on This Week in Startups, because I randomly decided to send Calacanis an email to ask him what I thought I should do with Prezo.
Right.
Random. And now we're doing the show.
Yeah.
Now, I can't say it's changed my life, but it's definitely opened up an interesting new avenue. I mean, it's an interesting new thing.
So are you recommending to our listeners to go out with a pair of dice and roll them and just make up different choices for whatever the outcome of the dice are? Just start doing random stuff.
I think we should. I think that's probably not a bad idea. It's kind of like, you know, you end up going to the same restaurants. You know, interesting. A friend of mine named Travis Kalanick. He is a successful entrepreneur. He sold his company Red Swoosh to Akamai a few years back. And he has a group right now. I just talked to him yesterday. He's like, we're talking on the phone. He's like, yeah, I'll be out. I'll contact you because I'm flying down to South America. I've got Argentina. I'm like, really? Why? And he's like, well. He's like, I'm part of this random travelers group. So he and a bunch of other of these Silicon Valley entrepreneurs got together, and they get a globe, get like an Earth globe or whatever. They throw it in the air, and someone with a blind hand catches it, puts a finger on it, and that's where they go.
Oh, that's funny.
And they've been he's all these random places off of Africa and New Zealand, and I can't remember all the places he told me. And he's like, yeah, they go for a couple weeks, and he says it's just an incredible thing. And I was like, that is awesome. That is so cool. But yeah, that's a perfect example, right? I mean, because otherwise you might be tempted to just go to the same place everybody else goes. You know, okay, well, you know, and then you think you're being really different and you're going to go, oh, you know, we're going to be really different. We're going to go to Tokyo. It's like, okay, well, you know, oh, no, we're going to go to Prague. You know, it's that different. But
they have a thing in Europe, they have a thing called interrailing. So what you can do is you can buy one ticket and it will take you on all of the train systems through Europe.
Right.
And it makes it really easy to do this because you know, you just land in a station and you just randomly pick a platform number and then you can go anywhere into Europe. And so I remember one time I was in Paris station and did this kind of random flip thing and just got on the train and ended up in the mountains of Switzerland.
Right.
And it's just fantastic.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, it just changes your perspective on everything. It opens up new ways of thinking. I don't know, just it's really... You know, when I think of the things that I've done that have been really interesting, especially sort of in this web space or professionally, it's been things that it's due to things that I've done that were sort of random, right?
Right.
The whole, for instance, the way I met Travis, the guy I just mentioned, is because this is back like 2005, and I'm working on Prezo by myself. I don't know anybody working on web apps at all.
Right.
And I think, and I'm reading a little bit of this TechCrunch blog, and they're talking about throwing a big party out there. So I said, screw it. I'm going to drive up to San Francisco. I'm going to drop 5-6 hours up to San Francisco. I don't know a single person, and I'm just going to go. And I did. And it was really uncomfortable and weird at first because I didn't know anybody. But I ended up, you know, ended up meeting a few interesting people. I ended up meeting Travis, who we've stayed friends, and he's a really, really cool guy. And I actually ended up having a long conversation with Arrington. I ended up crashing on his couch that night.
Jason, the party crasher Roberts,
which isn't like me, right? You know, I was one of the last people there. I was
well, given
there,
that you don't even drink.
I don't drink anything, but it was funny. It's like I was there, and he's like, "Hey, you know," he had asked me. I think I've told the story a long time ago, but I'll just repeat one part of it. He's like, Arrington kind of came up to me. He's like, "You know, so do I know you, or who are you?" Because he thought he recognized me, and when I told him I'd driven up from LA, he's like, "That is awesome! I can't believe you drove all the way up here for this." He's like, "Oh, what are you doing?" And I told him about Prezo, and he's like, "That is awesome!" He's like, "Stick around a little bit. I want to introduce you to Scoble. Tell him what you're doing." And you know, all that stuff happened because I drove up there, and then he's like, "This is great." He's like, "Whenever you're ready, to just let me know, and I'll blow it out. We'll do a huge exclusive or big thing on it, right?" And that's because I went out of my way, drove over there.
You took a risk.
I took a risk. And the other thing, and I have to tell you, when I first got up there, and there's like 400 or 500 people there, and I'm walking through that door, and I don't know a single person. It's like one of those college parties you go to when you can't even move. There's so many people, and you don't know a single person. But it seems like everybody knows everybody else, and you're like, "Oh, this was a mistake." What am I doing here, right? This is terrible. But, and then after 45 minutes of feeling extremely awkward, like I should just leave. This is a really bad idea. I just go and I stand by the fire pit and I just get warm for a minute. And that's when Travis was having to stand there. He's like, hey, so what are you doing? What are you working on? You know? And that meeting, like, I guess Tom Conrad was working on Pandora or something.
It's you see, you know that story you just described just there? This is what you don't understand. This is what alcohol gives to you. Like that 45 minute wait that you had of feeling awkward gets reduced to about 15 minutes when you drink.
Maybe so.
Because you just kind of get into the spirit of things. That's the great, you know, alcohol just gives you that warm glow that lets you feel like you're in there.
Even if you're not. You know, and the other example I think I want to mention is when I had heard about the initial bar cap up in San Francisco, and this guy named Kareem Mayan had posted on some blog somewhere that he wanted to do one. He was in LA, and I emailed him right away. I was like, hey, I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, let's do it together. And we ended up putting some work into it, and we met up with a few other guys. One of the guys, Sean Bonner, I think he does like Boing Boing and stuff, and another guy, Ian, I can't remember his name. And we ended up doing this thing, and I meet a lot of interesting people who I've stayed friends with, and that's how I met Isaac from Central Desktop, right? And that's how we became really good friends. Hmm. And that's what's the most important thing is, right? You end up meeting
people. How long
ago
was this?
I'm thinking 2005-ish.
Okay.
2006. So, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. And the problem is I haven't been doing enough of that lately. So my network, my opportunities haven't expanded as much lately because I've done less just going out of my comfort zone and doing random things.
Well, you've got more kids and you've got more expenses and you're focusing on consultancy. You've got more clients. So, you know, you're just growing up, really. That's what the issue
is. Well, I don't know. It's probably just the rationalization. I could still afford to do things. But, you know, it's interesting because Sandy is always – because there'll be like some – conference or something, and I'll be like, I'm not gonna go, this is all bullshit. And she's like, why do you say that? She's like, almost every time that you go do something really interesting happens out of
it. Yeah.
And so I'm like, yeah, all right. So she kind of like gives me a kick in the ass and just says, you know, you need to go, and go even if it turns out to be a dud, just go.
I've been meaning to go to the LA CTO forum. They happen I don't know, once a month on a Friday morning at 8 a.m
right?
But it's just every time it comes around to it, I don't know, I've been drinking the night before or something like that. And it's like, God, I just can't get up. But I should just do that. Just drive in.
So essentially you're saying I should drink so that I would feel more comfortable in weird situations, but you're not going to any of these things because you drank the night before?
That's happens sometimes. But it does seem really early. 8 a.m. 8 a.m. Like 8 a.m. for an Englishman.
Yeah, that's brutally early. That's like when friends of mine over the years say, who had offered to teach me how to surf, and they're like, yeah, we'll get out there, it'll be 5 in the morning. I'm like, not happening, dude. I'm not driving to Malibu at 4 in the morning. There's just no way.
What time are you usually at your desk at work by?
8:39, depending. I could be at about 8:30, but I like to walk. Sandy takes Colby, my five-year-old son, my oldest of the three, to school. The school's like 3 blocks down the street. And I usually just walk down with them. It's nice to get outside and take a walk for, you know, to and from the school and spend a little time with her and the kids.
That's nice.
So, you know, so that ended up working 9. But I've noticed, and I actually thought about bringing this up in the show a couple times. I've noticed that instead of coming straight from just, say, you know, getting up and eating breakfast and getting dressed and sitting down and working, that by getting out and walking a little bit or getting your body moving a little bit and getting out in the world, I at least feel more anxious. Like, okay, I want to sit down and get something going. Like, I feel more awake.
This is another case of asking Jason the time and he'll build you a clock.
That's right. Well, that's why we're doing this show, right? If I just said yes or no.
Do you find that because we do the show and because you talk so much or during the show, do you find that it kind of releases that tension for you during the week so you don't need to talk everyone's ear off during the week?
Dude, I could talk all damn day. It doesn't matter. I could talk for 5 more hours. We could do like a 5-hour show.
Is your family like that? Where does that come from? Is that just you?
Mostly me. My grandmother, I remember my mom's mom, she used to say to my maternal grandma, I should say, she used to say to my mom, she's like, good God, was he vaccinated with a Victrola needle? Which is, for all those who don't know what a Victrola needle is, that's a record player needle. You know, because I was just like, the kid never shuts up.
Unbelievable.
Which my dad was quiet. My mom was a talker. She's the kind of person who, if you're in line at a grocery store, she'll start joking around with you.
Do you do that? Do you talk to strangers?
I do all the time.
You do?
I'm the kind of guy who'll be joking around. There'll be like 5 or 6 people sitting there awkwardly, and I'll be the one start joking around and making everybody kind of laugh.
You do talk to strangers in the park. You've already told me that.
Oh, yeah. I talk to people constantly. I can't stand to just sit there and be quiet. It bores me to death.
So you can't sit. You can't deal with silence. You can't just
I can sit and be silent with them. The thing is, I can sit and code and just listen to music or listen to podcasts and write code for 8 or 10 hours, no problem. But I love talking to people. I love joking around and stuff. So, you know, if I have an opportunity to, I'd rather do that than not.
When I code, I listen to ambient tracks, right? And I'll put on the same
whale noises.
No, not like as in ambient music, like chill out music, right? Or yeah, just generally
hip-hop lounge kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but I'll leave the same album on cycling like 20, 30 times.
Sure. Right?
And I won't notice because it's just good background. It's like white noise, basically.
Yeah.
But my wife, Georgie, she'll be in the room next door and she will come in and she'll be going, "Oh my God, do we have to listen to this crap again?"
Yeah. It's funny. I used to do that back when my first startup and we would, I remember we listened to this Duran Duran album.
Okay.
I mean, like for 2 weeks straight. It was that and the Pet Shop Boys.
The Pet Shop Boys. Oh my God.
And they weren't even particular. It just happened to be the CDs that I think my friend, my buddy Phil had.
So you listen to you listen to the Pet Shop Boys and you talk to strangers in the park.
Listen, it wasn't my CD. Okay. I don't have any control over it. We would argue about it constantly on what we were playing. And, it was his DVD player. So he was in control.
I take no blame
for that, but I know what you mean. Yeah. You gotta music definitely can help me stay focused. If it's just complete silence, I get really bored and I start doing other things.
Yeah, exactly. Music gives you some kind of drive when you're coding, which is kind of important.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's about that time. That time to close it.
All right, that's a wrap. We're out.
Well, we can finish up with the positive. So we start with the positive, give the criticism in the middle. So basically you give them a critical sandwich.
Yeah, no, I think critical sandwich.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you a critical sandwich.
So you
first
give them
butter
good,
you up, yeah, then I slap you down, I'm going to put some butter on you again.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds great.